Please help me welcome our speaker for tonight, Megan from Chatham, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, geez, you turned the lights off on me and everything? I wanted to picture you guys in your underwear. Good. My home group is a sponsorship group. We meet on Sunday nights in Chatham, New Jersey at 8:30. It's an open traditional speakers meeting, so everybody is welcome. It's an enthusiastic, lively bunch of mental patients that for some reason they let out, and we all hang out together. And I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I sponsor women today in Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of my home group and strong sponsorship, I have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is July 11, 2005, and some days I hope that my actions show how grateful I am prior to what I think or feel for the day. You know, gratitude for me is about action, and it doesn't matter how I feel, it matters what I do. You know, I've been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as they're outlined in the Big Book. And, you know, I'm here to share with you guys a little bit about what happened to me and what I'm like today and how I've recovered from alcoholism and how I found a God in my own understanding that restored me to a little bit of sanity, you know. And I stand up here fully clothed and in my right frame of mind, so I'm doing pretty good already, you know, which is not... This is not where I came from. I love to drink. I don't know if anybody can relate to this. I love alcohol, and you know, from an early age, I knew that there was something about alcohol. I grew up in a family where alcohol was always present at holidays, and I had this Uncle Jimmy. I love Uncle Jimmy. He's my favorite drunk ever. And Uncle Jimmy likes to drive his car to the front yard. And, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, there's Uncle Jimmy in the front yard, you know. Every year we're like, thank God he didn't go through the window. This is good. And I saw Uncle Jimmy was awesome. Because he used to hang out in the basement with us at family events. And the basement is where they kept the refrigerator with the booze. So, naturally, all the kids were downstairs, and we'd wait till Uncle Jimmy got drunk enough to pass out, and we would help himself to whatever was left. And, you know, I clearly remember alcohol being there, and I think that if somebody had told me not to drink it, I probably would have, and I would have got here a lot sooner. You know, which doesn't say much today. I take a drink and something happens to me that if you don't have this, you don't understand what I'm talking about. Because I hate the world. I hate you guys. I hate my family. I hate myself. I hate being here. And it always feels like there is something better and I'm missing out. You know, and I take a drink. And you guys ever get that knot? Like, sober, I have this, like, knot in my shoulders. And it doesn't go away. And it just feels like my muscles are so tense and I can't relax and I can't talk to you guys. And a drink just makes that go away. You know, a drink makes me able to breathe again. You know, and I'm here to talk about alcohol. And I can tell you that of no fault to my own, I found some non-AA approved conference substances to control and enjoy my drinking at an early age. And I didn't know at the time what they would do for me. But I'm a weekend warrior, and I would drink on the weekends, and I would smoke pot the rest of the week. You know, and that was my early period of drinking, you know. And I found that for somebody like me, it was not easy to get alcohol whenever I wanted to, you know. And no fault of my own, trust me. And eventually I figured out there's this old trashy bar in my town. I love trashy bars. And Obviously, I was not old enough to get in. And I don't look old enough to get in now. So they would not let me anywhere near the front door. So I used to stand outside this bar in my town, and I would wait until the older gentleman came outside to smoke a cigarette, and I would flirt, and I would hustle, and I would try, and I would, you know, I would work them, you know what I mean, until they got drunk enough to go next door because there was an attached liquor store. You know, and I would convince these guys that it was cheaper to go get a bottle next door and come outside and drink with me. And and I think I was 12. It might have been 13. And they would, you know, and I had a blast drinking with these older gentlemen outside the bar. And at this bar, I met my best friend and my drinking buddy. And his name was Malachi the Magician. And I loved Malachi. And he was this homeless guy with grave emotional and mental disorders. And the state of New Jersey legally gave him marijuana. And because I can't buy booze at this point, I would convince Malachi to go get me alcohol. And he and I would drink and smoke pot together. And we would drink on a park bench in the park. It's all hours of the night, and we would stare up at the sky, and we would talk about how wonderful life is, and he smelled, and I started drinking, and I didn't care how he smelled, and I start drinking, and I take my clothes off, and he didn't seem to mind either, you know, so every night I'm hanging out with Malachi the Magician, and after a while, you know, from the beginning to the end, I seem to think that it's a good idea to take my clothes off. It doesn't matter where I am or who I'm with. I, for some reason, find this new sense of freedom, and I'm willing to share. And terrible. And Malachi would, you know, I like to wander too, and I'd wander around town, and Malachi would follow me, and he would pick my clothes up, and, you know. And 3 o'clock in the morning, there's Megan drunk on the park bench, passed out, and Malachi the Magician is putting my clothes on. Malachi the Magician could not take care of himself, you know, and he would put my clothes on, you know. And I thought, there's no way I have a problem with alcohol. Alcohol is not the problem. The school system is definitely the problem. You know, and my parents are definitely the problem. And those friends, they are definitely the problem. And I thought if I could just live to be old enough to be 21, then I would be okay. You know, and I had a lot of ideas about what I thought I needed out of my life. And I don't know where they came from, but from a very early age, I found out that if I managed my life, right, that maybe I had some kind of control. And the reality is that the more I managed, the more I sucked the life out of everything around me, and the less control I really had. You know, a lot of the times it was very easy to see the lack of control because I like to wake up in golf courses. And I can't control that, you know. And then there were other times where I really, really, truly would wake up in the morning and feel like, I am going to go to school today. We are going to do this. We are going to get up, and we are going to go to school, and we are going to do it. And 10 minutes later, that is not a good idea. You know, and I would stand in front of the mirror every morning, and I was the type of girl that would put on outfit after outfit after outfit, and I would look myself in the mirror and thought, these just aren't the right clothes. They just don't fit right. If I just had the right clothes, and I would put on another outfit and put on another outfit, you know, and I'd walk out the door looking like my closet just attacked me, and somebody would say something to me on the school bus, and I would say in my head that I should have kept the first outfit on, you know. And then I felt like there's nothing that I could do in my life to fit in. I felt like I could not communicate with you guys. I could not be honest. I was so desperate to be liked. I would do anything for you guys to like me. You know, and in middle school, right, Oh, God, this is going back. It was like the cool kids table. I don't know, maybe you guys have a cool kids table. We had a cool kids table. And I thought if I could just sit at that table, right, then I would be okay. But in order to sit at that table, I had to control the situation. I had to wear the right clothes. I had to look the right way. I had to have the right hair color. I had to have the right padded bra. You know, I had to have the right things, right, on the outside to be able to go over there to have people like me. So what I would do is I would manipulate and I would con and I would lie and I would steal and I would cheat. And from an early age, those are the character defects that I have that worked for me. You know, and I suffer from this disease that of perception. You know, in reality, I found out that I am not a nice person when I got here. You know, and that maybe if I was a little bit nicer to people, they would have invited me to come over. But instead, I'm a gossip, and I'm a con artist, and I'm a liar. You know, and I'm fake. And these people would see that. You know, and I didn't see that because I was so desperate for you guys to love me. I needed your approval. I needed you, you know. And alcohol makes it so I'm not worried about what I'm wearing or who you guys are. You know, I feel like I'm the prettiest girl in the room, right? And I'm the best dressed. And you guys should be lucky to be around me. And your boyfriend wants me, you know. And that's what happens when I drink. You know, and my mom, she doesn't get that experience. My mom has half a glass of wine at Christmas dinner, and she twirls it around the little glass, and she smells it. Ooh, it smells so nice, you know. And she has a little sip, and she sips on it. And all night long, she sips on it. And then she leaves it there, and it's half full. You know, I don't drink out of a cup. You know, I don't get that experience, you know, and me, you know, I get the same kind of reaction on the outside, right? My cheeks get just as rosy as hers, and my voice just gets just as loud as hers, and I probably just get annoying just as much as she does. And but I think it's a good idea to go to the ghetto to find some crack cocaine. My mother does not do that, right? She stops. She says, I've had enough. I'm starting to feel it. You know, I have to drive, right? See, I love drinking and driving. I love feeling it, you know? I hit that point, and I am gone. And there's nothing that's going to stop me, you know? And I found a great way to control and enjoy my drinking. I started smoking crack. You know, it solved my alcoholism, and seemed like a good idea at the time. And you know, and I played chemist, and I thought, well, I could switch this, and if I could just do this, and if I could smoke this, and snort this, and pill this, and you know, if I could just find the right concoction, I can not black out, I can not pass out, you know, I could not sleep with your boyfriend for once, and everything would be okay. You know, and no matter what I did, the more consequences I had. And I didn't have a lot of outside consequences. What I had was a lot of inside consequences. Because the longer periods that I was not drinking, the periods of sobriety or dryness became absolutely incredibly unreal. They became so painful. It became painful to be me. And I couldn't look you guys in the eyes anymore. You know, and I hated myself, and I would have to drink, and the longer I drank, the shorter the periods got, you know, and I stopped, well, I didn't have a lot going for me to begin with, but the school system thought that I was no longer, should be allowed to be there. They disapproved with me smoking crack in their bathroom. I thought it helped me focus. That was what I was taking to the grave. And so here I am. I am now being kicked out of school, and I'm going to an alternative school where there's 8 people, and yes, the short bus picked me up every day. And the worst part was that I was alone on the short bus. It was just me, you know? And And so I go to this school where they lock the doors behind you, and I have a personal counselor and people on staff and a security guard at the front door. And I'm hanging out with kids that, like, got kicked out of school because they harmed somebody physically, you know, or they were dealing drugs, or, you know, they just were, you know, absolute degenerates, and I loved it. I loved it there. It was great. I felt like, these are my people. This is wonderful, you know? And in that school, I had a personal therapist / counselor. And one day, I went to her, and I said, you know, I just don't feel right anymore. You know, I just don't feel like I can do this anymore. And I said, I just don't feel like I want to live. You know, and I learned that that is not the thing to say to a counselor. Because instead of the short bus picking me up from school that day, the ambulance did. So here I am in a white padded room, and some guy down the hallway is screaming to let him out. And I just thought, oh yeah, I do not belong here. Like, this is not for me. You know, and they stand across from me and they ask me a bunch of questions, and I do what I always do, and I lie. I said, this was just a big misunderstanding, right? This was a bad idea, you know. I didn't really mean that, you know. Like, she took it a little bit too harsh. It's okay. And they let me out that day. And I thought, yes, score. You know, I got to leave. And I was really afraid they were going to keep me there with the crazy guy in two rooms down. And, you know, and so I learned that I had to be very careful about what I said, you know. And I really think that there was a part of me at that moment that really wanted some help. I really wanted some help. But that fear and that drink were more important to me still. And from that point forward, I had a series of events, just like everybody in this room, that brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was no longer showering after that. I was no longer dressing appropriately. I was now sleeping with people for money. I was going into project buildings at 3 o'clock in the morning with people named T, Gubba, and Bones. And I was hanging out with guys that we were called, you know, Casper, but he wasn't very friendly. And, like, those were my people. And I was scared, and sometimes I was scared to close my eyes, because I thought if I blinked for a brief second that they would not let me out, you know. And I started wearing Timberlands that were like little boys' fives that I had stolen from some drug dealer in Patterson. Bad idea. Patterson is this, you know, this crazy ghetto where we are. I don't know if anybody's heard of Patterson. So I was wearing Timberlands, and I was wearing guys' sweatpants that had, like, logos on it of, you know, baseball teams that were non-existent, you know, the Newark Bears and the Patterson Beavers, and, you know, and I was wearing one of those flat-top baseball caps on, and I had long hair at the time. And I would slick my hair up really, really tight, and I would try to cover my hair with a baseball cap. And I was, and that's how I'd walk into a project building. And I was afraid that if I opened my mouth, or they thought for a second that I was a female, that I was not going to be leaving on my own will. And I was so afraid that they were going to take advantage of me sexually. And I could not stand the feeling anymore. And I was scared, right? But I did those things sober. I did those things sober to get a drink or a drug, because I could not be in my own skin. I could not focus. I could not talk to you. I had no emotion other than, how can I get this gone? And I wasn't sure what this was, you know, but that hole in my soul that I know today is this was so big that I felt like I had a big giant bullseye in my stomach that just said, you know, she's dying on the inside. I was dying on the outside, but I was dying on the inside. you know, and I weighed 85 pounds, and my hair was falling out, and I was miserable. And in that condition, I came to you guys at 17 years old to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my first meeting, I realized the other day, my first meeting was actually an AA meeting, believe it or not. But it was a gay men's NA meeting. And they thought that they were confused, to say the least. And my mom had brought me, which was even worse, you know. And I walk in, and there's all these big guys and biker hats and just craziness. And, you know, and they're like, oh, you should stay. You know, and I'm like, no, I'm just here to see the minister. That's why I'm here, see the minister. And I walked out. And, you know, my life and my sobriety has hung by seconds and inches of what God can do for me. Seconds and inches of the choices that I have to make. And luckily, by that point, I was in a treatment program where my counselor said, she had this miraculous idea. She said, well, why don't you just pick another meeting? And I said, well, that sounds dramatic, you know. I thought they were all like that, you know. And that's what I did. And I don't know why I made that decision. It was probably because I had to get a paper signed and I didn't have a choice. But I knew that she was right, you know. And little things like that that people said to me in early sobriety, they are why I stand here today. Because if nobody had said that to me, I probably would not have gone back. I don't think I would have gone back. You know, so my next meeting was Alcoholics Anonymous, and I walked into this room where everybody looked really old, and I thought that I was walking into bingo night, and I was very upset about this, you know, I was very angry, and I walked in, and this old man, Bob. I know today you guys aren't as old as I thought you were, but when you're 17, everybody looks old. You know, so it's my excuse. And it's so funny because I meet these, like, 16-year-old girls, and they're like, how old are you, 40? No, God, I remember that feeling. And, you know, and this guy called Old Man Bob, I nicknamed him that. And he came up to me and he gave me a big hug and he said, you just keep coming back. And I cried, you know, I just cried. And I truly believe that he wanted me to keep coming back. You know, I didn't know that was like a saying here. I just thought he's really nice and he wants me to keep coming back. This is great. I can hang out with Old Man Bob now. And but I felt something. I felt the love that he had. And he still has that love today. I see it in his eyes. I see in his eyes that he has this God love, you know. And I did. I kept coming back, and I went to AA with a girl that I was in treatment with, and I came back every day in 90 meetings in 90 days, and I didn't get a sponsor. But one day I looked around, and Jen wasn't there. Jen wasn't at the meeting, and I grabbed somebody and I said, do you know where Jen is? And they go, oh, Jen got drunk. And I, you should call somebody. She's not allowed to do that. You know, you have to keep coming back. Like, that's how nobody could even, like, get through to me. I was, like, so delusional and so oblivious to what was even happening here that people just, it's okay. It's all right, Megan. Just come tomorrow. Just come tomorrow. And I was the girl that would show up an hour before the meeting, and I would wait, and I would chain smoke cigarettes, and I would wait for the first car to pull up, you know? And that person would get out and say, hi, I'm so-and-so. How are you doing today? And I'd say, oh, and I'd just dump out this, like, emotional vomit on them about how crazy I am and how my mom and the rehab and the school and everything else and blah, 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 blah. And I would just watch these people's faces change, you know, like, okay, all right. You know, and they would do the thing where they would just kind of back up slowly. And when I was done with you, I would move on to the next person who showed up. You know, and now that the coffee's late because I just kidnapped the coffee maker, I would go to the next person who showed up, and I would vomit all my emotional garbage on you, and I would do this to every single person that I could possibly grab before the meeting and hostage. And then I like discussion meetings in early sobriety because I like to talk about me. And since I just talked about me for the hour prior to the meeting, I was now willing to talk about me during the meeting, you know? And I'd raise my little hand, and I would share all this stuff. And then after a while, I'm like, oh, wait, I lied to that person outside, and I said something different during the meeting, and, you know, and it was just terrible. And and the whole meeting would be about Megan. And I would be so mad. I would sit there with my arms crossed. I thought, you're not supposed to crosstalk. You know, and I'd be so mad that everybody was talking about me and trying to help me during the meeting. I'd be so mad. And I would drive home, and I would think, oh, this AA stuff just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You know, and they would give me phone numbers, and I would call these women, and they wouldn't pick up, and they wouldn't call me back. And I realized now that I was calling them at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were probably sleeping. But I did not realize that then. I thought everybody should be up at 2 a.m. It's the fun time of the night. And because I couldn't sleep. I couldn't shut my head off, and I couldn't focus. And then I would see one of these women who put their name on the phone list, and they would share during the meeting, and then I would criticize her in my head. Oh, she didn't call me back. I'm not going to listen to anything she says. You know? And I was just very judgmental of everybody in the room. And I know today that what I was suffering from was alcoholism. I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. You know? And I finally got a sponsor, and I heard them say, find somebody that has what you want. And I found this gorgeous, blonde-haired, beautiful woman. And she had a job, and she had a car, and she had a house, and she had a really hot boyfriend. And those were the requirements to be my sponsor. Because I thought this was like, you know, Nike advertising here. And that she was going to drive me to meetings and buy me cigarettes. And maybe I could sleep with her boyfriend's friends. And that was the extent of my relationship with her in early sobriety. And thank God she had those things on the outside. I was attracted to those things on the outside. But what I know today is I was actually attracted to her inside because God had given her all those things on the outside. For some reason, I saw her. I heard her, you know. And she would invite me over her house, and she would open up the big book, and she would read it to me, page by page by page. And when it was asking a question or saying a prayer, we would stop and we would do it, and she would explain things to me. And the first time I went through the first three steps, it sounds like, wah, 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 alcoholic, wah, 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 we need to pray, wah, 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 you're very sick, wah. And I was just like, and I was like, okay, let's do anything, you know. And we would meet all the time. And she was a nurse, and she was like a health fanatic. And I would go over her house and, okay, let's do the steps. And she'd say, we are going to go running. And she would give me some shoes and some sweatpants, and we'd be giant. She'd be talking about God, and I'd be like back there just trying to keep up. And then I would go to meetings, and my sponsor's trying to kill me. You know, like, she must not know I smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day. And just keep running. And I really thought she was trying to kill me. I think that I just had so much energy that she did not know what to do with me, and that seemed like the only way to calm me down. And I don't know. I truly loved her. And she gave me a piece of paper after we got on our knees and prayed the third step prayer, which at the time I did not know what God was to me. I started to believe that maybe I was an alcoholic, you know. But I, like I said, I really just heard want, 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 okay, and I just said okay and just did what she told me to do. Mostly because I didn't know you could say no today. And so I start writing this inventory, and I start writing down all my resentments and all my fears and all my sex inventory. And I'm going to meetings now. Now it's starting to clear up a little bit. Now I can hear what's going on. And I heard people share about, you know, being very honest on this inventory, and then they burned it and gave it up to the God Almighty. And we rip ripped it up and threw it away. And I'm thinking, okay, I can do that. We're going to burn it. Great. I'm thinking, you know, I could be honest on this, right? Because, like, nobody's going to read it. We're going to burn it, you know? And one day I was done, and she said, all right, this is what we're going to do. And we went to a park in my town that I used to drink at, and she picked it, not me. I thought it was significant. To me, I felt like it was the beginning of my alcoholism and the end of my actual addiction there, when I actually started recovery. And what happened was she said, okay, start reading. And I was like, you know, like, okay, let me take a few pages out first. You know, I would skip over some names, and she'd be like, do you want to go back to the one you skipped? You know, or what about that page over there? You know, and I would just read them down. And what she did for me was she shared things about herself that I thought, you should not be talking about that. Maybe I should go get the police. Does anybody know you did that? You know, and it made it easier to share about the things that were like very surface level for me, because even those things were really hard to admit. They were really hard. You know, I did not want to talk about how I was resentful at my mother and my father, you know, and my friend. I did not want to talk about that stuff, but it just kind of came out, and I was willing to just try. And when we were done, 4 hours later, she put me on this bench, and she said, okay, I'll be back in an hour. And I just thought, oh, she's not coming back. She is not coming back. You know, I'm like looking for the police. I'm like, should I call somebody? You know, the first half hour, that hour that she told me to sit quiet, you know, I panicked the whole time. I really panicked. And something happened in that hour. And I just thought, you know, if she doesn't come back, I know where I am. You know, if she doesn't come back, I'll be okay. You know, and then I started thinking, like, well, she told me to read, you know, she told me to read through the steps and do that third step prayer again. And I thought, all right, I can do that. And I started to do that. And then, you know, 40 minutes later, she comes back. And I'm like, all right, that wasn't so bad. You know, and she looks at me and she says, how do you feel? And I said, oh, my God, I don't know. I don't know, because I'm a feelings type of girl, right? I'm like up, down, homicidal, to suicidal, to crying, to hitting, to screaming, to brat attacks, to, you know, curling up in a ball in the bathroom. I mean, I'm an emotional wreck all the time. And it was the first time in my life that I did not feel anything. My head had shut off. I could not think anymore. And it was the most amazing experience that I ever had. I believed from that day forward that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. And it worked for me. And I believe that there is a God, because there's no way that on my own human power that I could have shut my head off. Because drinking got to a point where I couldn't even shut my head off anymore. But this worked. And I could be still. You know. And because of that, physical things started to happen. Like I could sit the whole hour through the meeting without having to get up 10 times to smoke a cigarette. You know, and I stopped hostaging people outside the meeting, and I started to like listen to the meeting and make friends during the meeting and social and going out after the meeting. And it made me feel like that fourth and fifth step made me feel like I was part of the world again. It made me feel like I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and after that, going through 6 and 7 and saying that prayer every night, and I had a lot. I was a little confused on the character defect thing, right? Like, I knew I was a thief, you know? I knew I was lustful. I had the inventory that was, like, this big to prove those things. You know, I knew I was a con artist, but I couldn't stop. And even in sobriety, sometimes I would walk into a store, and I would come out with stuff in my pocket. And I'm like, did I do that? Oh, it's all right. You know, and I would just keep going. And after a while, I'd be like, you know what? I'm going to put that back in the store. You know, and pretty soon, my character defects that I had when I came in here, they didn't necessarily go away, but I became aware of them. And I became aware of how I was hurting people. And sometimes I would say things to you, and I would think, oh, that wasn't very nice. That wasn't very nice at all. You know, and then the next time I'd say, you know, because it would eat me up inside. And I'd be so scared. And sometimes I would go up to that person and be like, you know, last week I said something to you. I was joking, and I know it was hurtful. You know, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have said that. You know, but it only because it was too painful to hold in anymore. You know, it just became so painful. And pretty soon those character defects, they started to change, right? Because I'm no longer a thief today. Right? But I still have the tendency to lie. I don't know if anybody can relate to this. You know? And I still have the tendency to be about self. You know? And I know that when I'm in self, it's because I have lack of God in my life. You know? And making those amends were very important to me, because I started to see that when I made amends to you and I said, these were the things I had done to harm you, I was lustful, I was flirtatious, I was a liar, I was a cheat, I was manipulative, you know, I was rude, I was a pig, you know, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, I really am those things, you know, and I'm the type of person that was so oversensitive about you calling me names, you know, and I realized, They were true. And then they didn't have power anymore. Because I finally knew who I was. And I did not want to be that person anymore. I didn't want to be that person. And once I started making amends, I just made amends all day, every day, all day long, as much as I possibly could. I sought out people. You know, my sponsor suggested I didn't seek out drug dealers, but they said that they're okay where they are. You don't owe them the money. And because she was a little afraid I was actually going to do it, you know, and I loved it. I had a good time making amends. And, you know, I'll tell you, I was always really resentful of my father. And I thought it was my mother I was really resentful at. But it turned out to be about my father. And I was over-mothered, under-fathered. My father was never home. He loves to drink. He would get called out at dinner time, and I would want to play with him, and he would have to go to work. And I just felt like he didn't love me because I wasn't a boy, and I'm an only child. And I just thought if I was a boy, then he would love me, right? Because, like, I don't do fishing trips. You know, I don't go camping unless it involves, like, an electrical outlet and a shower, and I just don't do those things. They're not in my makeup, and I just thought if I was something different, he would love me. My dad's a bit of a hoarder, and he worked in the ghetto in Patterson, and he would pick stuff up that was broken on the street corner, and he would refurbish it, and he would put it back together, and he would try to fix stuff, and then he would give it to me, and I hated him for it. You know, I thought that this made our family poor, that people would know that this was garbage, you know, and I would hate him. And I was never at all grateful for the things he did for me. And when I looked at that inventory, and I saw that the reason that my father wasn't home was because he was working overtime to be able to put me through college. You know, he was working overtime so that I had all those clothes and all those resources. And I played sports on 3 different soccer teams. And he bought every car I ever had. And, you know, and because of those things, I realized that he really, truly loved me. And that the only way that my father could connect with me was by being of service to me. That language was not of my making before I came here. You know, and I realized that he was giving me this stuff because it made him feel good. And he loved me. You know, and I see it in my kids today. I have 2 beautiful little boys. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, they have never seen me take a drink or a drug. You know, they've seen me in untreated alcoholism. You know, but they have never seen me take a drink or a drug. And my dad, when they walk in the door, they're so excited to see Grandpa. My dad comes over and he loves them and he kisses them and he hugs them and they're everything to him. And I look at them and I think, I bet that was how my dad treated me. I bet that was how he treated me. And every resentment I ever had went away. And I stood in front of that man who I hated for so long. And I said, thank you for showing me how to be a good mother. Thank you for showing me. You know, I love who you are today. You know, since this last year has been a really tough year for me. And I've really had to live in 10, 11, and 12. It's been a really difficult year. My son was 6 weeks old, and we found out that he had this very rare condition where he was going to need major surgery. And a week after that, his father relapsed and picked up a drink and decided that another girl would fix his problems. And he decided he was going to do it with my credit cards. And I'm at home with this baby, this newborn baby, who the doctors are telling me could have mental disorders for the rest of his life, have permanent brain damage. And here I am, this guy, this alcoholic, was robbing me of every ounce of sanity that I ever had. You know, see, I learned what I did to people when I say I robbed you of your sanity, you know, because it happened to me. And I looked at those men in a whole different way, especially to my parents, you know, because I could not sleep at night. I could not eat. I could not focus. All I could do was cry. It was so hard to get out of bed. I hated him. I hated the other girl, you know, and every day it seemed like my bank account was becoming negative, more money, and more credit cards were missing. And he would come and go as he pleased, and there would be booze in my refrigerator, and you know, he'd be calling from the bar, and I'd be on the way home from the AA meeting, you know, and I just kept thinking, if I can't beat him, I'll join him, you know, and it turned into this game of which girl is gonna win. You know, and I was stalking him, and I was stalking her, you know, and GPS tracker on his phone, and her social security number, and a whole bunch of crazy stuff, and I was crazy. I was calling my sponsor on the way to this girl's house with a bat, going, I promise to say the serenity prayer, but I will kill her. And I was serious. I was dead serious. And I would sit outside this girl's house, and I would watch them. You know, I'd watch them. And I would just think to myself, if I go in, I'll lose everything. I'll lose everything. You know. And meanwhile, I'm driving my son to 4 different doctors, 4 different specialists every other day to all parts of New Jersey, and I'm driving around and I can't afford gas in my car, and I'm going to AA meetings and I'm raising my hand and I'm crying. And I'm crying, you guys. And I'm sitting here and I'm going, I'm going to leave here and I'm going to drink. I just can't do this anymore. You know, this isn't working anymore. You know, and people would take my son during the meeting. People would come to my house, and people would call me during a surgery, and people would take me out to eat, you know, and they would love me, and they would absolutely love me, you know, and I just thought, why don't you guys just leave me alone, you know, why don't you guys just let me die, because this feeling is worse than living, you know, this feeling is terrible, you know, see, I know that there's a God. And I know that Alcoholics Anonymous works because I'm standing here today. And I did not take a drink or a drug or anything else. You know, I did not have to harm myself in any way. Lucky for her, anybody else as well. And I found my sponsor, the same sponsor I have today. And I would call her every day and I'd be screaming and yelling and she'd be talking about God and I'd be saying, I'm not doing that. That's not going to work. You know, you don't understand, you know. And then one day she said, you know, do you think that if he was still in your house that you would be drinking with him? And I thought, yeah, probably. And she said, well, maybe God put her in his life to remove him from yours. And that the whole time you thought he was killing you and he was really protecting you. You know, he is ruining her life instead of yours. You know, well, you have the biggest God I've ever seen. You know what I mean? And slowly but surely that resentment would just go away. And I gave up. I gave up. And I said, okay. You know, thanks to the police department, I found out that you could file restraining orders. And that was one way to remove him from my life as well. He stopped bothering me after that for a little while. And I got better. Once I removed him physically from my life, I removed the sickness because he became a drug for me. He became my God, and he was killing me. And slowly but surely, working with my sponsor, I came back to a God of my own understanding. You know, but I literally was sitting in doctor's offices crying. Just, I could not look my son in the eyes because everything about him reminded me of him. And I hated it. I was so embarrassed to say that out loud. You know, today my son has had two major surgeries and sees a lot of specialists, and he's a happy and healthy little boy, you know, who has a sober mother today. And I could not be grateful to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that gave that to me, that gave me that, you know. And my life is not what it was a year ago. It's not what it was, you know. And I went from that person to having a full-time job, to supporting myself, to taking care of my children, to being a productive member of society, to sponsoring women. Now, I would go to meetings crying, and this girl, she must have been really sick. And she came up to me and she said, if you could stay sober through this, I want you to be my sponsor. And I thought, I asked her, are you sure about that? I said, all right, call me tomorrow. And I'm thinking, somebody's going to tell her outside the meeting, you know, maybe it's not a good idea, maybe she finds somebody else, you know, maybe they'll kidnap her. And that girl called me every single day. And I'd be crying in a mess, and there's my phone ringing, you know, and there's her, and she'd be complaining about the job and the boyfriend and the school, and I'd be listening, and I'm going, is this all you got? Is this it? Like, that's it, you know? Like, you got to make something up for me. Jeez, you're killing me. You know? Because it just seemed like, oh my God, that's it? You know? But slowly, I started to love that girl. And I focused all my attention on her and all my energy. And she's still sober today. I'm not her sponsor, but she is still sober today. And every day I see her, I think, thank God I didn't kill you. There must be a God. You're still here. You know, and just sponsoring people, even through that situation, has truly saved my life. Because even though I don't think I'm qualified, God believes I'm qualified. And God's put people in my life numerous times, time and time again, of people that I can help. You know, and people who I've done inventories with and seen myself and grown from that and all my experiences and taken those things and to make somebody else find, you know, to help them find a God of their own is beautiful. It's beautiful. Sometimes I have no idea. My sponsor goes on about these spiritual rampages and I'm like, what the hell is she talking about? And then a new girl calls me and I'm like spilling out the same things. I'm like, yeah, you know, and I feel it. And I'm like, oh, that's what she's talking about. That's the feeling, you know. See, my sponsor constantly reminds me that in that second step, God gives me power back. I get power back, you know. I get God, and God is my employer. And if I just suit up and show up and be present for where I am, that God will use me as he sees fit. You know, and just amazing. This has been an amazing ride in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank you guys for my sobriety today. And I hope I brought you a traditional message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if not, I hope I didn't kill anybody. So, thank you.